Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you've tuned in today. We're looking at a topic many parents are trying to get a handle on. Teenagers spend a lot of time online. The vast majority of them use the internet every day. One in four kids between the ages of 13 and 17 says they are online almost constantly, according to the Pew Research Center. For many teens and tweens, their online lives are as important as their lives in the physical world. But because it is easy to be anonymous online, the internet is fertile ground for predators. Children are the target with frightening regularity. Child pornography, online sexual solicitation, and other forms of child exploitation have become so prevalent that the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, which was once a small national law enforcement network, has grown to 61 coordinated task forces. The Maryland unit received 1,656 complaints in 2014. The internet also heightens the damage teens and tweens can inflict on one another. An embarrassing picture posted on social media can permanently stain a child's reputation, and cyberbullying can have tragic offline consequences, as the headlines often remind us. How can parents preserve their children's innocence and keep them safe in this new digital world? To help answer these questions, we've invited two experts from the Baltimore Child Abuse Center. Adam Rosenberg is Executive Director of the Baltimore Child Abuse Center. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sheila. Good afternoon.
And Drew Fidler is Policy and Program Development Manager. She's also forensic interviewer at the center. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Two notes right off the top. The Baltimore Child Abuse Center will present a three-part speaker series on tweens and technology this weekend at We Chic Boutique in Greenspring Station. For more information, visit the Midday page on WYPR.org. We'll have the details there. And this other point, I know this is a topic I really hope parents will take advantage of this hour to pose your questions about keeping kids safe online and to share your experiences. Our toll-free number is 1-866-661-9309. Our email address is midday@wypr.org, and our local number is 410-662-8780. Again, 410-662-8780. We'd love to hear from you. So, Adam, let me pick up on this discussion series. You're going to have a session for kids, a session for parents, and then a joint session like a week later. What prompted you to develop this speaker series now? Is the number of child abuse cases connected to the internet on the rise?
I think a few things prompted us to do such a session. We've been working in close collaboration with We Chic, who have a great program space, and I think we both recognized an ability and a need to get important information out there. And each week we see a case, both locally and I think even nationally in the news, where there is some form of internet usage which has been used to facilitate the crime. You look at the Nicole Lovell murder in Virginia. You look at the Deontay Carraway exploitation of children.
That's so new that maybe you should take a couple sentences.
Certainly.
To tell us the federal charges were just filed this week in Prince George's County.
Right. Unfortunately, they were there. That I think it really shows the gravity of the situation there. That, look, in Deontay Carraway, there's a 22-year-old unpaid volunteer working in a school system who apparently not only sexually abused at least 17 kids in the school, but gave them phones and produced, you know, what has been commonly referred to as child pornography. But the reality is, Sheila, that this is evidence of a crime, that these are sexual images of exploitation there of him with these children, and uploaded them using the Kik app, K-I-K, which seems to be increasing its frequency in its facilitation of internet crimes.
So,
and the federal nexus, of course, is that's the production of child pornography.
And you mentioned the Nicole Lovett case.
Yeah, so Nicole Lovell was a 13-year-old girl in Blacksburg, Virginia, who was unfortunately alleged to have been murdered by an 18-year-old Howard County student there. A 13-year-old girl met him online using the Kik app again. And I think it, you know, goes right to the heart of what's the struggle here, where, you know, when we look at the classic movie scenario where the guy shows up at the house to date the daughter, right, and he pulls up at the door and he comes out of the car and the dad's able to size him up while daughter's walking down the stairs, that doesn't exist anymore because that interaction's going on in your child's bedroom and you don't even know it. And so children are interacting with adults online, and are often way over their heads. And so part of the real need behind this series is to simply level the playing field, that we know nothing about this technology as parents, and I think kids know a lot more about this technology than we do. They just don't necessarily appreciate the dangers that present itself from being involved in this tech without proper supervision and education.
Drew Fidler, part of your job at the Baltimore Child Abuse Center is interviewing children after there have been allegations of abuse. Give us some examples of cases you've encountered that had an online component.
So I think we've seen a rise in these cases without a doubt, that whether or not it's evidence in the case or that the technology has facilitated the crime or an increase in child porn cases in general, that a lot of the different cases that we're seeing, there is some element of technology involved. And one of the things that we always ask teens about is, how do you communicate with your friends? Because especially in an interview, you never know where the evidence lies, and you never know if there's going to be more there than there should. And we, you know, we've had a couple of cases where this evidence has led to either greater charges, like Adam was saying. You know, that element of child pornography does take it to a federal crime. It does make it sort of that much more a higher issue than simply, you know, the messengering. But a lot of times these are kids who meet online, or they may have known each other, right? A friend introduces, so for example, a child is introduced to somebody because they are a cousin of someone online. And in Baltimore, cousins can be anybody, right? So they are introduced to someone because they are a cousin, and they are communicating online, whether it's through Facebook Messenger, whether it's through Kik. They're having this communication. Child agrees to meet up. You know, child assumes this person is 14, 15, 16, whatever they say online. And when they meet up in person, the reality is very different. They're 21, they're 22, they're 30, 40. And that relationship is already there. It's already built. This is someone who they know, someone who they trust, right? Somebody who gets them in a way that their parents can't. And so automatically the relationship is very different than it was before.
Adam, what role does GPS technology play in this?
I think there's a few things. You know, that GPS technology is also tied into a lot of the photos that we're posting online, you know, through any one of these apps, Facebook or otherwise. And so not only is there a timestamp, but there's a location stamp. And that, you know, one thing that parents can do, everybody can do, is going into your settings. And if you don't want to be sharing where that photo was taken, then we need to be turning that off. And it's a very simple thing that can be done. You just have to go into the settings on your phone and on your online social program to not share those settings, because it's buried in the metadata of that photo. So when a child shares with a purported friend online as to where they are, that, you know, right away, you know, people know where you live, whether you want them to know that or not. The good news about it is that I think some of that information has been used to help solve crimes as well. So we can see photos, we can see postings, and we can have a sense as to where they came from there.
But also, if you look at Instagram, right, you can pull up a map, literally a map of where a child's been, where they've taken pictures, and it shows you pretty much someone's daily routine based on how they post.
And so part of internet safety, I think, isn't necessarily about not posting naked photos of oneself online, but even just being aware of what's being posted to begin with, because
any photo would help make that map, help someone with ill intent figure out what that
kid's
normal
flight path is, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm speaking with Adam Rosenberg and Drew Fidler, both at the Baltimore Child Abuse Center. We're talking about the risks teens and tweens face online. And it's a great time for you to take advantage of their expertise. Parents, do you worry about who or what your child might encounter on the internet? Or has your child already met someone unsavory online? Tell us about it. Call 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. What are the most common mistakes parents make in dealing with all this?
I think the most common mistake is we don't talk to our kids about the potential risk of technology, right? We have kids who have developing prefrontal cortexes. They are already inclined to take more risk and to try things because they don't know they don't know where the line is. And so I think that ultimately, right, we're not communicating with our kids about what are the risks online and where are the risks. The fact that gaming, right, you can get on your Xbox and connect with anyone around the world through that Xbox. And what does that do? And how does that interaction need to take place? What information are kids giving out? And what information are they not? And so I think that ultimately, right, it's not that the technology itself is scary. I mean, it's ever-changing. It's hard to keep track of. But it's more about, as a parent, you don't need to understand every app or every small technical thing that could occur. But you need to be aware of the privacy settings, of all of the communications you can have with your child around building a safer world online, right? We wouldn't ever let kids just run off by themselves to go somewhere or to do something. And when they are in their rooms at night and they still have access to their smartphone or their iPad or even their gaming system, they still have access to the internet. And so all of these things are happening outside of parents' purview.
I guess I just assume, and again, I'm not a parent. I'm not raising kids. So I don't have like daily contact with tweens. But I'm assuming they don't want to talk to their parents about this. That's the whole reason they're online, is because they want to have these other relationships or these other connections. Mm-hmm. Maybe they don't think of them as relationships. I don't know. But I would think they're like, okay, yeah, mom, what, yeah, and they just kind of roll their eyes until the conversation's over.
That's pretty accurate, actually. I mean, being someone who's raising tweens,
oh,
it's a challenge.
Adam,
Sheila.
I was hoping you were going to tell me I was wrong. And
no,
kids
I
are
think
thirsting
that's
for
it.
Contact with their parents.
I think
on
they're
this.
Thirsting for contact, which is why social media has become such a remarkable platform to be able to do that. It's because they can have that communication with each other, with their friends, with people who they think are their friends, in some sense, without that facial judgment, so to speak. It's an easy, quick form of communication for them. And we just need to be, you know, the big risk as parents is we just need to be enforcing rules in that world as well. And we need to not be afraid of being the bad parent, but really trying to hopefully be remembered as the loving, nurturing parent who protected them from the outside world.
And simply by being your friends, your child's friend on Facebook or on Instagram, you're not necessarily going to see everything, right? Kids know the control settings. They know who they can put on limited profiles, who they can put on full view profiles. And so how do you, you know, look at the privacy settings that your kid has set up to help protect them from the opportunistic offender, right? The person who just runs into them. Because kids want to belong. Teens want to belong. They need that interaction in order to develop their own sense of self and identity and who they are. And that's a very positive thing, right? We don't want to negatively impact that growth and development. But what we do want to do is help to make sure that kids have healthy boundaries on that, right? A certain amount of risk in life is good, but how do you make sure that your kids are taking healthy risk and not exposing themselves to offenders or posting things that when they go to apply for college, when they go to have a job in the future, comes back?
You know,
right,
we're at a dual risk here as a parent, because in one sense the kids know far more about how this stuff works than we do, and on the other side, the offenders, the pedophiles, the bad people of the world who are trying to get to our kids also are far more clever than we are. So you've got two different parties that are out there, Sheila, trying to take advantage of a situation that generally as a parent we're not well versed in. And that's the heart of this We Chic series, is I think being able to level the playing field so a parent has a better understanding about the risks that are presented and then can adequately present.
And that's exactly what we want to delve into in this hour. We need to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Adam Rosenberg and Drew Fidler of the Baltimore Child Abuse Center about the risks that young people face online and what parents can do to help them. I'm Sheila Cass. Parents, do you trust your children to make wise decisions on social media? How do you monitor their online lives? Join our conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Today we're talking about the threats young people face on the internet and ways to improve their online safety. Adam Rosenberg and Drew Fidler, both of the Baltimore Child Abuse Center, are with me here in the studio. Drew, I want to pick up, before we go to calls, I want to pick up on what you were saying about privacy settings. Both of you actually were saying, and Adam was saying, kids and predators understand it better than parents, probably. But that's exactly what struck me. You were talking about kids essentially using privacy settings to screen out their parents or to limit what their parents can see. So they're that canny, and they don't want their parents there. So how does a parent then get to have the conversation and make it stick about the risks that they're taking with privacy settings?
So I think that that's a great question. Ultimately, right, there's even, just to take it one step further, there are even apps that that promote that secretiveness, right? There's apps called Vault where you have to go through your calculator and all of a sudden it opens up this whole new world of communication. I think that ultimately parents can be aware of privacy settings, right? NCMEC, the Center for Missing and Exploited Children, has a great resource sheet in terms of being able to understand what the privacy settings are for each of these different apps that are incredibly popular today, and to be able to start to understand that and how that works. I think also when parents are setting those boundaries and having those conversations with kids, part of it is saying to them, look, there may be times where I'm going to look through your phone. There may be times where, right, that this is a privilege. It's not a given that you can have access to this all the time. And that if you engage in something or if you engage in this behavior, you're putting yourself at risk. And part of this, a child may look at a parent and go, uh-huh, yeah, sure. You know, you're putting yourself at risk, not just to predators, but to other kids and to bullying and to... Right, that something like 25% of middle and high school students have been cyberbullied. And that when you put those pictures out there, even if you're Snapchatting and you think it's going to go away, it can be screenshot. It's going on to
a... Snapchatting is a platform that supposedly disappears, but it doesn't really.
It doesn't really. Any of those sort of messengering services or picture sharing services where they're supposed to disappear, they don't really disappear. Whether or not somebody takes a screenshot, whether or not somebody, it gets caught on a server somewhere, right? Or you take the picture on your phone and then upload it, that instant, that picture isn't really going to go away. And so kids need to understand there are long-term consequences. And I think that's how you start to create those boundaries, is talking about some of those long-term consequences that can come from what you think is just a momentary fun thing, including child pornography. When you snap a picture of yourself naked, or when somebody else snaps a picture of you naked, that's essentially manufacturing child pornography the way the law is written. And then it gets sent out. Now, when it comes to teens and being charged for that, I don't know. But I think that you need to be aware that what you're doing is actually illegal, right? That if it got to a certain point, that's actually illegal. And once it's out there, it's incredibly difficult to get it back, if not near impossible.
And how, Adam, I know you're a parent of young
tweens,
young teenagers, right? So if you make that kind of argument, if you try to have that kind of conversation, how does it tend to land?
I don't think it's a conversation. I think to be successful, and I think we'll know one day if we were successful or not, but I think to be successful in this, it's multiple conversations. I think it's those small bite-sized moments. I think it's teachable moments. I think it's about using the episode of Glee that you've watched, or reading, you know, an article in the paper, or one of these Nicole Lovell like tragedies, and being able to say, look, these aren't just the hysterical ramblings of your parent, but these are very real things that happen there, and being able to consume it in bite-sized nuggets along the way, I think makes it an ongoing conversation and dialogue rather than just a one-time only event.
We had a caller who couldn't stay with us who posed this revolutionary question: what about not allowing teens access to cell phones.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if that's realistic anymore. I think that the cell phone is such a part of our age, and it has its good and its bad purposes there. I think that they're just going to be able to connect with the world in some other way, because it's not just the cell phone that connects one to social media. Between your Xbox and your smart TV and your computer and the computer you have to use at school, kids are entirely plugged into the outside world. And by cutting off only, it's like the Hydra, Sheila, right? We cut off one head of it, that the other ones will just be available to grow back. So it really, the cell phone's not the enemy. Facebook isn't the enemy. The enemy's using those platforms to be able to exploit our children. And I think we need to be able to take the upper hand as parents to be able to put the right safeguards in place to inform and educate and monitor what's going on out there. And that when something happens, we have to report it. It is a travesty what happened in Prince George's County, that an entire school seemed to have an idea that something was going wrong with this Deontay Carraway case, and nobody reported it to Child Protective Services. And so if one person sees something that's awry, whether it's a parent, whether it's a teacher, on someone's phone, it's time to pick up the phone and report this and do something about it before it's too late.
It's also like the kid whose parents don't allow them to have junk food. They know where they can go to get that, right? They know where they can go to connect. We've had kids in the center who mom's like, I never gave them a phone. I don't know how they got online. And the reality is they were using their friend's phone or they were using their friend's tablet, right? So that even in the house where you don't give a kid junk food, they're going to find the friend's house where they can get that food.
So you have to have the conversation. Phil from Baltimore is calling us with, I think, a point about schools. Phil, welcome to Midday.
Yes. Hello.
Hello.
I think it's a very interesting conversation. I have three sort of observations, having had young children. One is, obviously, this starts, the conversations with your child have to start much earlier than when we're talking about. And I think part of those conversations that as they get older, and by that I mean three or four or five, that when issues come up, you have to make, I would say, contracts with the kids, that you agree to do something and they agree to do something. So that by the time you get older, it's sort of a way of going that they think is fair. They found it fair. In other words, we do what we say.
Okay, that's one point.
Okay, second point is that in all of this, I hear you talk about parents really as isolated individuals. And on the whole, at least we had probably the school we were at the time, we talked a lot to other parents. And this was earlier before some of the issues we're talking about even existed. But we talked to other parents. And so there was a lot of discussion going on back and forth of what do you do, what you don't do. So you get ideas and you begin to find out what the other kids are thinking about.
Parents and working together.
Parents. And then the other is that kids, schools, what the school is doing. In other words, is the school promoting in some of their classes discussion of some of these issues? Again, it's in another setting. Again, it's this way of trying to get kids to talk about, take some ownership.
Okay, let's
Phil, you know, I think you raise a good point, Phil, about schools. And I think that schools need to be a necessary partner with parents to be able to help with this education. That, look, I know just enough about algebra to help my kids with their homework, but I don't know enough to really teach it there. And I think we look at schools often to be able to help fill in those gaps where we as parents haven't been able to have these conversations and lessons or aren't comfortable with doing it. The number one thing you, Phil, and anybody else can do right now is call your state delegate, your state senator, and get them to support something called House Bill 72. It's an effort that has made its way out of the House Ways and Means Committee and is going to be hopefully voted upon on the floor of the House this week. What it does is it provides sexual abuse prevention education in all of our schools in Maryland, and it would make Maryland the 26th or 27th state to do so. It's an effort called Aaron's Law, which has simply said that every year we want to make sure that we have education in our schools, age-appropriate, timely at different stages, so that kids have those tools as well to help protect themselves. If HB 72 had been passed in previous years, and we've been working on this for years, perhaps the tragedy that occurred in Prince George's County wouldn't have gotten so great. And so It's been successful in the House. We're hopeful for passage in the Senate and their EHEA committee in the coming weeks. But it's the sort of thing that will also cost the state nothing because there are federal funds that are already available to help make this happen.
Phil, thanks for the call. That was Adam Rosenberg of the Baltimore Child Abuse Center here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Drew Fidler of the Child Abuse Center. Nearly three-quarters of teenagers use more than one social networking site, according to the Pew Research Center. Parents, do you worry about what your kids are doing on these sites? Do you use parental controls on your child's cell phone, or do you trust them to make good decisions? Join the conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. We got an email from Mary in Baltimore, who says, with children ages 10 and 11, our family is in the midst of figuring out how to deal with technological security. My children desperately want Gmail accounts and tell me they're the only ones in their classes at school without Gmail. Gmail is supposed to be for ages 13 and over, though obviously that is easy to get around. Is it safe to let them have Gmail, and how could I configure Gmail to be safe? Also, more generally, is there some source I can turn to for guidance on how to give my children the freedom to explore social media and the internet, but within bounds that keep threats to their safety and security?
I think the first thing you want to do is introduce one piece at a time. Let's not open up the entire World Wide Web to a child, but let's test drive and see how we do on Gmail, or see how we do with one site first. And then part of what the earlier caller had said, too, is about creating that contract between child and parent so that we understand what the rules of the road are. I mean, we don't give the keys to the car to the kid at the age of 16. We make them go through a driver's permit period there where they're learning how to do it. Part of the Gmail contract then is to be able to say that you can be on this, but I get to look at your emails. You don't get to delete emails, and that you need to be appropriate in what you're posting there.
I think also to be aware of the Gmail circles, right? They can then, there is that connection then to social media that Gmail has launched and that Gmail has available to you. You can video conference through Gmail, right? And so if you go into the settings, you can turn things on or off, and you can allow or disallow connection to certain things. On the broader sense, in terms of creating that contract or having help to craft that contract, you can go to netsmarts.org.
Spell that.
NETSM. Let me make sure I get it right.
There's a Z in there somewhere.
SMARTZ.
NETSMARTZ.
.org.
.org.
Yeah.
And what happens there? Why would a parent go there?
So one of the things that they have there is they have a website for parents. They also have a website for kids. And on the website for parents, they have a number of documents and resources, one of which is a technology agreement, right? A contract, which is exactly what we've been talking about, for parents and kids. And that you can print that out. You go over it with your child, and they're agreeing to it. They are signing this contract and saying, I am going to, uphold these standards when I'm online, so that it gives you something to come back to as well when certain things are violated or not.
And does Gmail strike you as a good entry point?
I think email is a good entry point. I do, because I think that it is that anonymous people are less likely to email you. The only way they can email you is if you've given them your email address. And part of that agreement too is that your kid's not giving out their email address at every kiosk and sign up site there. That you give permission as to when they can give out their email address. So we've really limited who they're communicating with in that sense there. Yahoo allows access to children under 13 with parental permissions and settings like that. iCloud may do the same thing.
I think also, though, it's monitoring where they're using the Gmail, right? Location matters, not just in real estate, in general life.
Where they are when they're online with Gmail?
Yeah, when they're accessing it. That location matters. And where are your kids? Are they in your kitchen, your living room? Are they, upstairs with the door shut, right? That are you able to walk into a room and know what they're doing? Or if you walk, if are they somewhere else completely off alone without the possibility or any threat right, of parental eyes.
It's about creating good habits early stages so that when we allow our kids access to Gmail, that it should be in a public place like a kitchen or a family room where everybody's around and not necessarily getting them on their Gmail in their bedrooms there. Let's set these stages early.
And kids do have lingo to alert other kids when their parents are in the room or things like that. So it's also, you know, keeping up to date with some of those little catchphrases.
Like, what is that? What is that abbreviation that as a parent I might spot in an email that indicates my daughter's trying to hide?
So sometimes you might see like a P with an I symbol with the I emoji.
Uh-huh.
Or I'm trying to think of the other.
So that
one
would be parental eye.
Right, mm-hmm. Parental eyes, or, you know, so.
Okay. Amanda is calling us from Dundalk. Amanda, welcome to Midday.
Hi. One of those initials you're looking for is PNR, Parent Near
yes.
Room,
thank
is
you.
Something that you should look for. I'm a program director for Delinquency and Substance Use Prevention in Dundalk, and I've done a couple of things with my kids that have helped. One, I am a conversation broker between parents. I am not a school administrator, I'm not a counselor, and I'm not a parent, but I'm able to have conversations with the kids and the parents, and we all set down the electronic rules together. There's also a rule within the center that if you're on electronic device, an adult's eyes have to be able to see the screen at all times. It's a habit that's formed in the center, and it's really easy for parents to go in the center, an adult has to see, at home, an adult has to see. So there's some backup for parents to have. So if parents can find a way to find a conversation broker with their kids to set up those rules is a really great tool. The kids that come in sign a contract, an electronic contract, and if you violate the rules within the center, that there are consequences. They know what they are. They normally pick them themselves. And we also do have nanny spyware on our devices. It tells us what sites they go to, how long they've been on there. If they've gone to a site that is not approved safe, we get an immediate notification on my cell phone. Since I'm the director, I get it. It tells me what they saw, and I'm able to immediately have contact with that kid about how they violated those rules.
Amanda, I appreciate the call. Do either of you have ideas about where a parent looks for a broker, a conversation broker? I mean, is that a concept that you use, and does it work? How can a parent get there?
I mean, I think that's one of the reasons in the We Chic series, right? There's that third piece of bringing parents and kids together, right? We are trying to be that conversation broker and to help parents and kids learn how to start having these conversations. I think that school counselors are a great conversation broker.
Trusted family members, older siblings,
right.
You know, people who, but I think it's also people who we trust and who we know are part of that circle there that aren't just part of the conversation broker series, but also another trusted adult that if a kid has a situation they need to be able to talk to someone about, we like to think they're going to come to us as parents, but they don't always. So we should hope that there's someone else that they trust and that we trust as well.
The aunt, the uncle, the youth group leader, the camp counselor, right? Sometimes they're going to know more about your kid than you will. And so both the youth-serving organizations need to train their staff to be able to have those conversations about setting healthy boundaries. But also, I think at the same time, we as parents can start to use those conduits, right, and start to say and navigate around that.
We need to take another short break here. Lots more to talk about when we come back. Adam Rosenberg and Drew Fidler from the Baltimore Child Abuse Center will still be with us, sharing tips for keeping kids safe online. And we've got more parents who want to talk to us by email and by phone. If you haven't joined the conversation yet, you can. If you're a teenager, I don't know why you're listening to Midday. I guess I'm glad you are. But have you had some experiences you think we should know about? Have you been cyberbullied? How did that affect your life? Join our conversation by sending an email to midday@wypr.org or by phoning us 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be back in just a bit. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Today we are talking about threats to young people online. I'm here with Adam Rosenberg and Drew Fidler of the Baltimore Child Abuse Center. The digital realm presents a world of new possibilities for young people, but also a lot of new dangers. You can join this conversation by sending us an email at midday@wypr.org. Or phoning us, 410-662-8780 is our phone number, 410-662-8780. We got an email from Alex in Montgomery County who says, "This is Alex, and in my high school in 2011, there was an assembly about the issue of sexting." And that's all Alex says. We haven't used that word. Have we been talking about sexting in any of these examples, or is sexting something different?
I think sexting falls under this as well. It's the sending of naked photos of oneself by text message. So sex plus text equals sexting. And I think that's a part of this conversation as well, is that transmission that you're not even using social media. You're just using the cell phone to be able to send that picture back and forth. And it's become an enormous issue, you know, in schools all across the country there. There are terrible examples of one high school in Colorado that discovered, you know, the Vault app that Drew was talking about, where kids were essentially trading sexed photos of each other, like baseball trading cards there. Until it was discovered and completely out of control. And essentially many, many children in the school were involved in this there, which had gotten completely out of control. And as Drew correctly pointed out, was also distribution of child pornography there. There's also examples of sexting being used to even blackmail children. There's one case I know from South Carolina where an offender posed as the hot girl in school and proceeded to send texts to other boys in school to say, "Send me a hot image of you." To which they then sent naked photos of themselves to who they thought was a girl, but in actuality was a pedophile sex offender. And then when the fake girl arranges a meetup, she's essentially blackmailed, or he's essentially blackmailed the child because he's got these photos there. And so the photos are even also used in furtherance of these crimes against children quite often.
And that, you know, 12% of teens who actually do sext have felt pressured to do that. So that it's not, you're adding that layer of internet to that normal, uncomfortable sexual exploration of teenage years that kids go through. That these aren't just text messages being sent back and forth. They are Snapchat messages. They are going through Kik that kids are sending these pictures, right? Or through WhatsApp, "Send me a sexy selfie. Send me this." And kids are doing it, and teens are doing it. And so they are sending these messages out. And it's one of those things we were talking about before, that once the picture's out there, it's very hard to get it back.
Yeah, I guess one of the things that parents need to talk to kids about is the extent to which colleges and future employers are checking out social media when in future years when it comes time to look for a job. I think that may not seem real.
Oh, we joke about this on my staff. I think even before I look at a resume, sometimes I'm Googling that applicant to find out what their social presence is. I mean, what stupid stuff have they posted online? Because I think that's an essential part of who somebody is there. And I think that in a business, in an industry where we're talking about child protection, there's a lot of dumb things people post. And I think that we do need to be careful about that and share that message with our kids, that someone's going to look at it one day.
And you can try and clear your digital footprint. Right? You could try and go in and take the pictures out of you doing things you shouldn't be doing, but the reality is they still exist. I mean, Google yourself and you'll find things you don't want up there.
Yeah, I haven't done that in a while. don't really want to. Ben in Harford County emailed us a question. What are app developers doing to address this problem, especially when it comes to sensitive data like location information? Why can't the developers of these apps have one set of settings for an older user and a different, more limited set for any user under the age of 18?
My thought is that, one, there's no incentive for the app developers to do it, that developing an app is a quick way to make money, and you know, having to put those limitations on it is just going to make the production cost that much more expensive there. And two is that the kids are smarter than us, Ben, and they're going to be able to figure out how do they access that. I mean, take the caller earlier who talked about, is Gmail. You know, their child wants Gmail, but it's 13 and over, but there are ways of getting around that. There are always ways of getting around these parental controls. The real trick is, as the parent, and as the school, we need to do a better job enforcing those rules and making sure that we're presenting a safe playground for our kids to be.
It's also that a lot of the apps have recognized that the U.S. has laws that they can't get around, and so they are based out of Canada versus being based out of the U.S., right? So there is that element, too. Kik, for example, is based out of Canada. They are not based out of the U.S. for similar reasons of, right, those laws and those issues.
Okay, so the short answer to Ben's question seems to be the app developers have no incentive and they're really not trying to
Right. I don't think they don't need to. And look, the other thing is, even talking about Kik, I would say one thing any parent should do is not have their child have access to an app that allows anonymous posting. So Kik can have people who are anonymous and are basically untraceable. And that's just setting up destruction there. I think there are better social apps that are out there, your Facebooks, your Instagrams, where at least you have to establish a real digital presence.
And with the same notion, right, you have things like Whisper and Yik Yak, which are anonymous apps which allow you to post things about anybody within a 5-mile radius, a 10-mile radius, so that, you know, now schools are starting to outlaw those on their campuses, but that when a kid gets home, right, anybody within a 5-mile radius can post something and can talk to that kid. And so I think those are also apps to reconsider and to talk with your kid about whether or not those are necessary things.
Nancy has called us. Nancy, executive director of CASA, CASA for Baltimore City.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make a comment that we are now getting cases of kids who are becoming victims of human trafficking, and oftentimes there is an element of cyber usage by the predator where kids are being coerced or just sought after through their internet access by predators who then lure them into human trafficking situations. And I was hoping, Adam, you could speak about it a little bit.
Yeah.
Nancy, thanks for calling.
You know, human trafficking, I think, doesn't just occur on its own, but is really preyed upon by the most vulnerable that are out there. So when there are children who have been victims of abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, have witnessed violence in their community, those are the ones that are more likely to start to become trafficked because they're running away from something into something else there. And the apps have made it, you know, social media, the internet's made it available to be able to more easily identify these children and post their whereabouts, post them online there. So, you know, it becomes another reason that, you know, we need to be able to monitor it. And I certainly, when we're investigating these cases as well, there are kids who are being trafficked, who are victims of domestic minor sex trafficking that don't even realize that they're being it. But we ask these questions because we want to be able to find the proof that backs it up there, which I think, you know, talks about the exchanges for money, for the transmission of images there, that kids may not even be realizing it, all helps facilitate that.
Nancy, thank you for calling. Scott has called us from Baltimore. Scott, welcome to the show. We're down to just a few minutes, so if you could make your point compactly, that would be great.
You bet. I'll be brief. Thanks for hosting the show and talking about this subject. It's near and dear to my heart. We started a company 2 years ago to build a machine learning platform to sift through social media and bring notifications to parents and kids about what's going on in their social media accounts so that they can have an intelligent conversation about it. If you wouldn't mind, I'd like to mention the website, but I'd also like to talk just very briefly about the distraction that kids are experiencing with technology and social media and how it's impacting them.
Well, we just don't have much time. I think what might make more sense, Scott, why don't you email us at midday@wypr.org your website, and we can put a link to it on our website.
Yeah, contact us too, Scott. I'd be interested in seeing how Baltimore Child Abuse Center can learn from that and work with that as well. You know, you can, you know, contact us also.
And your point about distraction, Scott?
Well, just there's an insidious nature to technology, the distraction and brain development, and especially in younger children, and we're just beginning to understand the research on it. But the harm that parents think about with social media and child predators is far less broadly impactful than the distraction of sitting in front of a game or having a handheld device in your hands for hours at a time. And I would just urge parents to read some of the research and understand the impact that this constant distraction is having on brain development and the child's ability to attend in school and to resist temptations later on in life.
Thank you, Scott, for that point. Anybody want to make a comment? We got an email from Maureen, who she says she has five children, ranging in age from 3 to 14. It feels like a full-time job to stay on top of internet safety. We have open conversations with them, but feel overwhelmed at times by what should and shouldn't worry us and the number of different products, iPod, Kindle, computer, Xbox. For example, I was surprised to learn the Xbox was pairing them with similarly skilled players to compete with. And she asks, as others have, what resources for both parents and children?
Well, some resources are certainly, there's great resources on the internet at our own website at BaltimoreChildAbuseCenter.org, at NetSmarts, which we described earlier there, to read, to go to the upcoming We Chic series that we're running. But I think part of it is being able to take the time. You're right, it's overwhelming to be able to take all this in and to still, you know, do whatever, you know, whatever your other full-time part of your life is. I mean, you know, living is challenging with all these different distractions there in terms of, you know, taking care of kids is absolutely a full-time job, and it's a lot. And when you add the threat of the internet and all these other parts of it, it becomes really complicated. And I think maybe part of it is trying to keep it a little bit simpler and taking measured risks along the way, so we're not opening the portal for everything, but maybe even encouraging our older kids to help monitor our younger kids there, or beginning to pull some of those processes offline. Or put another way, maybe the 1 hour it may take to learn how a platform works is worth the time and savings down the road of trying to deal with all these other distractions there.
I think also, right, where are your kids using these devices? Where are you keeping the devices? How often are they exposed to them? That can help as well, so that if you have more control over when and where the devices are being used, it will cause you less stress in terms of how do I even deal with this whole issue of the internet.
Yeah, the stress that we're hearing from parents is very real. We got an email from Elaine who said, parents need to be strong and not be afraid to be unpopular
That's
with
right.
children. For example, Ray Lewis, former Ravens player, said that his children put cell phones in his bedroom at night before bedtime. That addresses your point about...
Yeah, about location and that matters. I think that, you know, as a kid, I was not allowed to have a TV or a phone in my room. And I hated my parents for it. You know, they're probably listening right now and are not happy with me. But I understood it in the end, right? That just exposure to that screen before you go to sleep causes you not to sleep as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that ultimately, if kids aren't getting the sleep that they need, and we talk about this all the time with regards to teenagers, right? They need to sleep so many hours and eat so many calories in order to be able to grow and develop. And that just exposure to the screen before they go to sleep throws off their whole cycle.
And we are flat out of time. I really want to thank you both for opening the door for us on what is a really important issue for a whole lot of families. Adam Rosenberg, Executive Director of the Baltimore Child Abuse Center, and Drew Fidler, Policy and Program Development Manager, as well as Forensic Interviewer at the center. Thank you both.
Thank you for
thank
the opportunity.
You.
The Baltimore Child Abuse Center will present a three-part speaker series on tweens and technology this weekend at We Chic Boutique in Greenspring Station. For links to the series, visit the Midday page on WYPR.org. Lunch for our midday guest today provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies, locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Menu includes a variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. And thank you for listening. Something different on Midday tomorrow. Tune in for a conversation about Frederick Douglass, the most photographed man in 19th century America. We'll talk about the relation between photography and freedom. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.